When ESPN first launched in 1979, it was unclear how the public would respond to an all-sports cable channel. More than 35 years later, 80% of households with at least one television in the U.S. pay for ESPN. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Lindsay Moon, in for Ben Kiefer. ESPN has transformed the way we consume and think about sports in our culture today since founder Bill Rasmussen maxed out his credit cards to launch the network in the late 70s. This hour on River to River, I'll talk with Travis Vogan, University of Iowa Assistant Professor of Journalism and Mass Communications and American Studies, about his new book, ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. The Rise of Sports Media, coming up after this news from NPR. When ESPN first launched in 1979, it was unclear how the public would respond to an all-sports cable channel. 3 years later, a woman actually named ESPN in her divorce suit, claiming the network ruined her marriage by offering too much coverage. Today, more than 35 years later, 80% of households with at least one television set pay for ESPN as part of their cable package. The network has transformed the way we consume and think about sports as part of our culture today. I'm Lindsay Moon, sitting in for Ben Kiefer, and during this hour of River to River, we're going to talk about the so-called worldwide leader in sports. Travis Vogan is an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication and American studies at the University of Iowa. He is the author of ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. He joins me now. Travis, welcome to River to River.
Thanks for having me, Lindsay.
So I want to get started and talk a little bit about the history of ESPN, mainly because the network was a thing before I was born. So I was really interested when I got in to read that part of the book. Technically, ESPN is a thing because Bill Rasmussen, who's the founder, was fired from a job with a hockey team in 1978. What was his original idea for the network?
Well, his original idea, he was working for the Hartford Whalers and what was then called the WHL. And his original idea was to create a cable network that focused entirely on Connecticut area sports. And he was sort of pitching this to different regional folks. And they gained a little bit of momentum, but not very much interest. And they decided that a way to distribute this would be via satellite. And so they wound up getting a pretty good deal on some satellite space on this transponder car from RCA called SATCOM 1. And then they realized shortly after that that, well, we have this satellite. We can broadcast to the entire United States. And then people actually started getting interested. But nobody in Oregon is going to care much about Connecticut sports outside of maybe a little bit of basketball here and there. And so it wound up becoming this venture that was a national service devoted entirely to sports. And that's kind of how they got the ball rolling for that.
How did he go about executing on the network that he wanted to build?
Well, first of all, he needed investors. This was going to be an expensive endeavor. And so after a bunch of different meetings and getting some support from other sort of financiers, he wound up finding Getty Oil, an oil company, wound up funding the vast majority of ESPN's initial efforts. And then they needed content. And so they initially found a contract with the NCAA. And the NCAA had an interest in kind of expanding its reach because this was kind of on the heels of Title IX, and the NCAA was getting critiqued to some degree for not supporting women's athletics as much as it may have said it was going to. But also, it wanted to give exposure to those athletics. And so ESPN was going to be showing things and NCAA events beside from football. And so it was a pretty good deal for the NCAA in that regard, and so they decided to support ESPN, or at least signed an initial contract with them.
So I'm interested sort of when you talk about how he built the funding for the network. Initially, he maxed out his credit cards and borrowed money from family,
sure,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's kind of a wheeler and dealer, and he was doing it on his own for a long time or for several months. And so he partnered up with some people. He used his own capital, et cetera, until Getty Oil wound up coming in to sort of foot the bill as part of their diversified operations division, which is, you know, they had resorts and golf courses and stuff like that. And this guy, Stuart Evie, who ran that division for Getty Oil, was sort of a sports fan. And he fancied himself somebody who wanted to kind of get into entertainment and whatnot. Because while oil is this big, you know, incredibly lucrative business, as you know, it's not the most glamorous, maybe. And
right.
So he wanted to be in communications. And so he sort of encouraged the Getty board to back this endeavor. And, you know, it didn't make money for several years until they got sort of established by, you know, 1983, 1984. But that was kind of the push that secured the funding.
Sure. So initially, you sort of talked about the ways that ESPN found things to broadcast by signing an initial contract with the NCAA. If you would have tuned into ESPN early in the 80s, what sorts of programs would you be seeing? Sort of obscure sporting events, maybe?
Yeah, they did a lot of stuff that you could basically get the rights to for next to nothing. And so famously, they would do Australian rules football and tractor pulls and those kinds of things, and they would mostly show them non-live, and they could show a tractor pull or an Australian rules football game non-live because not many people followed them in the United States, and so it wasn't as if you were already going to know who won this tractor pull or who scored the first goal in an Australian rules game because you don't really have access to that information. And so they were initially showing these kinds of obscure events that were both inexpensive and that they could show non-live because you can't show a Major League Baseball game 6 days after it occurred because everybody, or at least fans, are going to know what went down because they're following the box scores in the newspaper and whatnot. But you can do that with some of the more obscure events. Also, ESPN couldn't afford to get the rights to Major League Baseball or the NFL, etc. And so that was both economical and sort of within the realm of their kind of distributional model. Also, one of the ways that ESPN did kind of build alliances with some of these more prominent sports was by finding ways to talk about them or cover them without having to show live games. So a good example of that that's actually coming up and has become sort of this big media event annually is the NFL draft. It wasn't broadcast before ESPN started showcasing it on TV. And it initially seemed like kind of a strange idea because it was essentially just a kind of business meeting or a conference amongst the owners and general managers. But ESPN started showing it, and there was interest in it because football fans would get to see these players who their teams would be featuring on the field the following season. And, you know, now it's become this big, like, you know, sort of quasi Miss America pageant with music and lights and all that kind of stuff.
Right. So I think I'm glad that you brought up the NFL draft because I wanted to talk about that. I mean, I know people who refer to the NFL draft as second Christmas and get really excited about it. When when did that start to take off? I mean, it's moved from when it was originally broadcast. For a while, it was in like a Sunday morning slot, and now it's 3 days of primetime television.
Yeah, it initially was a kind of business meeting of sorts, and it wasn't broadcast as much more than that. They would show maybe the first round or so and then have some commentary in between the picks because they have 2 or 3 minutes in between the picks for the teams to kind of reorganize. And so that's a nice little break for the folks to provide some kind of analysis and whatnot. And now it's become this huge kind of overblown thing that lasts several days, as you mentioned, and that's being hyped for several months afterwards, and that's being talked about for a couple weeks afterwards, or really until training camp occurs. And so I think that the NFL draft in a way is kind of serves as a microcosm for some of the ways that ESPN has taken these events that were once obscure and kind of blown them up into kind of larger sort of mega events that it can hype and that it can milk for, you know, or sap for all of its potential, commentary and resources and discussion, et cetera.
So. Right. And so, I mean, that's not the only example. Even though they don't have the broadcast rights anymore, ESPN sort of created March Madness.
Yeah. the NCAA tournament had been on television for a long time, but those first and second round games initially weren't broadcast nationally. So if Iowa was in the first round of the NCAA tournament, it would be on TV in Iowa, but you wouldn't see it in Florida, probably. And so ESPN started showing those games live on the, you know, Thursday and Friday. And it could, frankly, because it had the space. CBS already had, or, you know, NBC or whoever already had stuff going on during the days at that time. And so ESPN had all this space. And so they were able to showcase these games earlier on and, you know, created something that became, again, a kind of event that now, I don't know about the folks who, you know, say the NFL draft is second Christmas, but those first couple of days of the NCAA tournament are pretty fun. And that sort of started because of ESPN's capabilities to show this stuff during the day, to show it live, and frankly, the need for content and finding an opportunity with these early round NCAA games.
I think it's interesting in the example of March Madness, it is fun to fill out a bracket and compete in pools and things like that. Would you think it's safe to say that ESPN is maybe the reason why it's a huge cultural phenomenon?
Well, it certainly had an impact. I wouldn't say that ESPN is the only force that, you know, established an interest in sports 24 hours a day, you know, 365 days a year. I think that interest had been rising, you know, steadily. And I think that if it wasn't ESPN, it would have been something else. But I think that it certainly played a role. I think ESPN would like us to believe that it was the thing that set the ball in motion entirely. And it certainly played a prominent role. But I think that it was a combination of kind of technological and historical and cultural forces and, you know, commercial and business forces that led to what we now know as March Madness.
Sure. So we spoke a moment ago about how Bill Rasmussen started to fund the network. They set so many records for broadcast contracts, and they continue to set records for broadcast contracts. Can you talk a little bit about the money that is generated and is behind the network?
Yeah, one of the things that ESPN did that was pretty revolutionary in terms of the business of cable television is it created a dual revenue stream model. And so kind of like any other network, it sells advertising, right? And so you're selling advertising and you're getting money from that. But ESPN at a certain point became popular enough to where it could leverage its popularity with cable operators and demand that those cable operators, meaning people like Mediacom and CenturyLink and all that kind of stuff, in such a way that they could demand payment from those cable operators for the privilege of having ESPN as part of their package. So if Mediacom says, well, you know, we're just going to pass on ESPN, then a bunch of Mediacom's customers are going to say, well, we're going to go to this other company that's actually carrying ESPN because it became such a popular thing. And so ESPN created this dual revenue stream model where it's getting money per subscriber from the cable operators and also getting advertising revenue. And that's really what kind of created this incredibly profitable and lucrative kind of force that it's now become. And ESPN's so popular now that it's by far charges the largest subscriber fees of any cable entity. I think it's up to around $7 per subscriber. The next closest is TNT, or last I checked was TNT, and that's around a little bit less than $2 per subscriber. So the gap is incredibly wide. And that's kind of an interesting thing. It's also a little bit alarming because if you're a cable subscriber and you don't care about sports, you're still paying that $7-ish per month for ESPN because of the way that cable's bundled. Now, that's shifting, of course, with the rise of streaming and whatnot. But still, that's kind of how ESPN maintains this economic clout that it has and that it often flexes.
Sure. So I want to talk about some of the other networks that are trying to mimic ESPN's model a little bit later on. But first, I would like to talk a little bit about sort of the cultural influence that ESPN has had. And I want to read a short passage from the beginning of the book because it completely blew my mind when I read it. As part of its 25th anniversary celebration in 2004, ESPN included a segment that featured 11 young ESPNs, several of which were spelled ESPN. The name is now registered with babynames.com. So what, when you were researching this book and you found out that there were people that had named their children after the network, what was your initial reaction to that?
I thought it was kind of an interesting name. No, it was surprising. I mean, even though I'm pretty familiar with ESPN, it's amazing how deep its impact is in popular culture, to the extent that somebody would want to name their child after one of Disney's properties. You know, it's sort of interesting in that regard, and I think that it speaks to how important ESPN is and how it's spanned well beyond a cable outlet. Right, it's not just a TV channel. It's a sort of cultural touchstone. It's a way of creating community. It's a way of asserting your identity. And I think it really speaks to kind of one of ESPN's big efforts over the years, and that's to suggest that it's not just an entity that's delivering sports, but it's a framework through which we see the world, right? Nobody's going to name their kid ESPN because they think it sounds cool, or that they think it's, you know, just kind of a fascinating name or something like that. They're going to name their kid ESPN because of the meanings that we attach to ESPN. And those meanings exceed the realm of sports. And ESPN has done all kinds of things over the years to kind of ensure that this brand has meaning that exceeds sports, that it's powerful, that it has some kind of influence and weight attached to it.
I'm Lindsay Moon. You're listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm talking this hour with Travis Vogan, an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication and American studies at the University of Iowa. He's author of the book ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. So I'm also curious, you're a sports fan and are interested in sports clearly also from writing this book. Why do you think as a culture we love these, why do we love sports so much?
That's a really big question. I think that sports do a lot of things for us beyond, entertaining us, beyond sort of passing the time. I think they create community. They help us to kind of build identity. So you might be a Cubs fan, or you might be, in my case, a Mariners fan. And that kind of helps to define who you are. I think they articulate certain important cultural narratives and reinforce certain important cultural values, some of which are, positive, some of which probably deserve to be critiqued, pretty carefully. But sports have this kind of pull in our culture that's undeniable. If you look at the numbers for something like the Super Bowl, in comparison to the numbers for viewers of something that might be seemingly much more consequential, like a State of the Union address or something along those lines, it's pretty remarkable, that sports have this ability to captivate us. And I think that makes them a really interesting point through which to look at what does American culture mean. What do we value as Americans, or as folks beyond, America and the global framework? And why is sports kind of situated in this unique position? Why do we choose these events that on the surface seem kind of silly and frivolous as ways to tell the world and to tell each other and to tell ourselves who we are and what we believe, et cetera? So I think that, and ESPN obviously is playing on the power of sports to do those kinds of things. But it's not just showing us sports, and this is kind of the point of the book to a certain extent, is that ESPN isn't just opening a window onto sports as they exist, but it's really carefully curating a version of sports that's reinforcing a particular agenda, and that agenda is reinforcing ESPN as this kind of so-called worldwide leader in sports, or this authority on sports that provides us a kind of framework through which we experience and understand and know sports.
How did ESPN's approach to covering sports change sports journalism? I mean, I know that there ESPN did a lot for the sports documentary and does a lot of features on players and their backstories. But what do you think are some of the most prominent ways in which ESPN sort of changed the way that we think about teams and their players?
Sure. Well, I think that ESPN obviously wants to attract viewers. And so they want to make the sports coverage entertaining, right? And part of the way that you do that is by inflecting it with stories. They also want to broaden their audience, and so they're going to inflect their sports coverage with stories that they think are going to attract an audience beyond kind of the stereotypical sports fan. One of the things that's interesting about sports television in particular is that unlike political coverage or what have you, sports television actually pays sports entities for the rights to cover events. So ESPN pays the NFL over $2 billion a year to cover Monday Night Football. It's a very important property to ESPN. On the other hand, ESPN is suggesting that it has these journalists who are covering and who are kind of probing and who are sort of looking into and providing this kind of watchdog function to the NFL. Now, that's a sort of a conflict of interest when you think about it. Now, ESPN is going to say, well, there's these two divisions are separate. Our entertainment or our coverage is separate from our journalism. But there have been a lot of instances, or at least several instances, where that seems a little bit dubious. And so that's kind of an interesting thing about ESPN, that sort of speaks to how its coverage of sports is also serving a particular purpose and reinforcing a particular agenda that usually comes down to promoting ESPN, not necessarily promoting sports, but promoting the version of sports that ESPN creates.
Do you see the interest and sort of the passion for sporting events and for watching networks like ESPN in other parts of the world like you do in the United States?
Yeah, ESPN has expanded globally. It's in, it's all over the world. And its coverage reflects the kind of cultural norms of the different countries where it's present. So you're going to see, if you go to Toronto, you're going to see a different kind of version of ESPN than you do in the United States. That it's privileging hockey a little bit more heavily than you see. Or if you go to South America, you're going to see more soccer, etc. And so it's playing on the same kinds of cultural norms that ESPN plays on in the United States. But that effort to create a version of sports that serves ESPN's interests and not necessarily sports fans' interest or not necessarily the sports is covering's interest is something that I think is consistent throughout this entity's operations, right? Regardless of the particular place where it happens to be covering the game.
We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Lindsay Moon. We're talking this hour about ESPN with Travis Vogan, assistant professor of journalism and mass communications at the University of Iowa. He's also an assistant professor of American Studies. This is River to River. We'll be back after this short break. With River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Lindsay Moon, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Today, I'm talking with Travis Vogan, an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication and American studies at the University of Iowa. He's author of ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. So before the break, we were talking a little bit about how ESPN has sort of worked to build its own brand and at the same time has sort of inspired a specific sort of attention that we pay, especially to things like the NFL. I want to talk a little bit about the players specifically. In what ways do you think ESPN changed the way that we view sports stars as celebrities?
That's a really good question. I think that, it obviously has an interest in promoting certain athletes and building stars, building celebrities who we're going to have an interest in watching. If you watch, ESPN now, you're going to see a lot on Steph Curry or Bryce Harper. And what it does is it wants to create this kind of interest. And so it's going to show you maybe a short piece that talks about Steph Curry's upbringing or his relationship with his father or his work in, Oakland or something along those lines. And that might provide a kind of incentive for us to watch a game where he's playing. Now, this isn't something that started with ESPN. ABC Sports had been doing this, since the 60s with things like Wide World of Sports and Rune Arledge's up-close-and-personal approach to sports television. But it does have an interest in promoting these people in the same way that it has an interest in promoting leagues like the NFL and so forth. Now, one of the things that tends to happen or that oftentimes happens is that it creates, again, a kind of version of these individuals, just like it creates a kind of version of these organizations or leagues that doesn't necessarily correspond with the individuals that it happens to be representing. And so it creates certain expectations and oftentimes represents them in maybe kind of unrealistic ways or naive ways that eventually wind up disappointing fans when those players don't live up to those kinds of expectations. And then ESPN is, of course, on the back end, profiting off critiquing those players when they do transgress the kind of expectations that it helped to build through its coverage, whether it's its news coverage or its game coverage, et cetera. And so it's been kind of an interesting force in terms of creating or fostering a certain celebrity culture surrounding sports. If you think about someone like Tiger Woods, ESPN is just today had a feature story on Tiger Woods on ESPN.com that's part of the magazine. Now, this is a star that it helped to create, but this is somebody who's not been successful in golf for, going on a decade now.
But we're all interested in his story now because he built up and then made some mistakes and got some pushback for that.
Sure. Yeah, and ESPN obviously has an interest in that story, but it also kind of helped to create the story in the first place. And so you see it still kind of profiting off of these kinds of narratives that it both reinforces and also picks apart.
Do you think that in the way that some of those stories and features make players relatable, it makes us care more about them and about their success?
Sure. Yeah, I think that's the whole point in a lot of ways is to care about these individuals, to relate to them, to maybe identify with them, and from ESPN's perspective, hopefully to want to watch them play and want to watch stories about them, and so forth. And that's why you see so many stories about players off the field activities and, things that don't really concern sports are really kind of overblowing certain players who aren't really that significant as athletes. So if you think of somebody like Tim Tebow a couple years ago or Johnny Manziel now, these players that attract attention and that people seem to be interested in but actually aren't that great as players, ESPN is following those kinds of stories, right? Because those are stories that people are going to want to see.
Do you think that sometimes when sports stars are associated with certain teams, we think of them in a certain way that may not necessarily be accurate?
Yeah, sure. And I think that, you get a kind of reinforcement of those very simplistic kinds of narratives through the sports coverage, whether it's the Green Bay Packers or the New York Yankees or Duke, which is a really good example, or Georgetown basketball, etc. And I think that those are narratives that ESPN can very easily use to filter its coverage through.
It's right? Interesting that those franchises and those teams and those schools really mean something. Has it always been that way, or do you think that that's been a development of sort of our culture in the last 100 years or so?
Well, I think that, you know, they probably mean that to certain folks, but I think that it's also something that we've kind of created and reinforced through how we depict and talk about these organizations. I mean, if you ask a Yankees fan in the Bronx how they feel about being part of the establishment, you know, and being part of this privileged institution, they'll probably give you some pushback. That's probably not the way that they all see it. But from the outside, you know, it's depicted in this kind of really kind of ceremonial sort of way and historic sort of way. And I think that, you know, people seem to respond to that, and that entities like an ESPN or whoever, you know, it doesn't have to be just ESPN, have picked up on that and use it to kind of package material in certain ways.
I want to play a clip from a commentary that aired on NPR in 2009 by Frank DeFord. He's a regular commentator on Morning Edition, and it was called High and Mighty, ESPN Should Take It Down a Notch. We're just going to play about a minute of it.
Imagine if Vogue magazine was not only the country's single dominant fashion medium, but also produced most major runway shows. Imagine if the Wall Street Journal was not just the nation's only powerful business outlet, but it also owned the rights to the listings on the New York Stock Exchange. Well, essentially, so it is with ESPN and sports. ESPN rules the land, the seas, and the firmament of sport, and ESPN sees that it is good. ESPN has multiple channels, a magazine, a radio network, and now is starting local websites in many cities to compete on that level. What it covers is so often what it owns the rights to in almost every major sport. To be sure, other networks share some rights to the various leagues, but only ESPN is a critical mass. ESPN can make you. For example, it signed a 15-year contract with the Southeastern Conference for more than $2 billion, thereby sending every other conference into a panic mode, fearful that ESPN will make the SEC preeminent America's conference. It can do that. In no other significant part of American culture does one media entity enjoy such domination.
So I think it's interesting the way that got framed, because we've talked about this, the way that ESPN has a specific relationship with the NFL. How has ESPN tried to build credibility as a journalistic institution?
Well, that's really kind of what the book is about at the end of the day, is sort of how ESPN does these things to convince us and to build this sort of sense of sophistication or reliability or rigor that we don't typically associate with sports TV, which is stereotypically a kind of lowbrow activity. You're drinking beer and you're watching sports and that kind of stuff. And so one of the ways that ESPN has done this is by, for instance, producing documentaries. And documentaries are traditionally seen within the context of television as more thoughtful and edifying kind of material. They tell us about history. They're slower paced, etc. And with 30 for 30, it's not only producing documentaries, but it's hiring well-known filmmakers to direct them. It's doing so through an entity called ESPN Films, which is suggesting that these documentaries are filmic or cinematic. And it's doing all of these kinds of marketing strategies to suggest that ESPN isn't just showing us the game, but that's teaching us about sports. And in doing so, it's suggesting that ESPN is this kind of authority. It sort of holds the keys to sports meaning and significance and can tell us what sports means and why it means what it does. And so this kind of cultural ambition fuels ESPN's economic and commercial aspirations, because it's broadening ESPN's audience. It's helping to kind of offset any critiques that somebody like Frank DeFord might have. You know, I think that his critiques are absolutely legitimate, but ESPN can say, well, Frank, we're also producing these documentaries, and we're also publishing books, and we're also doing long-form journalism. So we are doing these kinds of edifying things. We're not just promoting the SEC, or we're not just promoting the NFL. Now, I think that a lot of these productions, the documentaries, et cetera, have a lot of merit. I think I've enjoyed several of them. I think they're quite good in a lot of ways. But there are also these sort of strategic practices that are playing off of some of these cultural assumptions about what makes quality television, what makes quality sports media, and why something like this might be more edifying or more educational or more sophisticated than just showing us a baseball game.
Sure. Part of the way that ESPN has also tried to build a little bit of credibility initially in the beginning was to try and poach talented and prize-winning journalists from other organizations, right?
Yeah. One of the things that it did earlier on is it would hire some of these journalists who had credibility and had built that through other entities. So folks like Peter Gammons in baseball. But then later on, hiring pretty high-profile people, especially in the early days of ESPN.com, it hired Hunter S. Thompson briefly to write for them. It hired David Halberstam, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, Ralph Wiley, these really great, really kind of established voices in journalism to help it to build that kind of credibility. Because all of a sudden, it's not just ESPN, it's David Halberstam, and he's under the banner of ESPN. And so ESPN is benefiting from his renown, etc. Or Hunter S. Thompson, right? And obviously Hunter S. Thompson attracts a certain kind of audience with his sort of gonzo and irreverent style journalism. And so ESPN was both, benefiting from these writers' renown and these writers' credibility, but also using them to expand its audience, right? Hunter S. Thompson attracts maybe someone with a different set of interests from David Halberstam, and Ralph Wiley is one of the best and kind of one of the really groundbreaking African-American sports journalists, attracts a different audience, etc. All the while building that kind of sophistication through their, journalistic chops. And
I think it's interesting the way that that's changed. Initially, they were trying to recruit really seasoned journalists, and you probably see this as a professor. Every third or fourth person in journalism school wants to work for ESPN.
Every first or second.
When do you think it started to change that they were poaching people and trying to recruit people to people like banging on the door trying to work for them?
Well, I think that there's probably always been a disproportionate interest in sports for those reasons we talked about earlier, that sports are something that people really enjoy and people really feel passionate about. But I think that ESPN eventually became this kind of authority on sports and kind of synonymous with sports. So it's not Sports Illustrated anymore as kind of the standard bearer for sports media. And ESPN has kind of done all of these things over the years to build and cultivate this image as the so-called worldwide leader in sports. And part of that is just being pervasive, right? And part of that is being credible. And I think that it's really carefully waged this campaign centered around its brand that has built that kind of credibility and has also built that kind of authority to the point where people think that ESPN is synonymous with sports. And that's part of the reason why it's so important to look at ESPN critically, because it seems like, to a certain degree, we might confuse the version of sports that ESPN creates with sports as they actually exist. And that version that ESPN creates is one that's reinforcing certain priorities that don't have a lot to do with sports and have an awful lot to do with ESPN.
What do you think would be an example of that?
For instance, we could talk about or think about its coverage of women's athletics, right? Still a very disproportionate, a very minuscule amount of the coverage that it provides is focused on women's athletics. But in reality, there's actually a lot of women's athletics out there. We just don't see it on ESPN, or at least we don't see it on ESPN represented in such a way that might reflect the actual percentage of women's athletics out there. And if we are suggesting that ESPN has the power to influence how we see sports, and we're accepting the version of sports that ESPN creates as the reality of sports, then we might not think that women are, equipped to play sports, or that Sure. women deserve to be celebrated for playing sports. I mean, that's a pretty obvious example, But I think that it's a useful one.
I think that's interesting because you'll hear people say a lot that, you know, there's no reason to broadcast things like that. Women's basketball shouldn't get as much attention as men's because it's a slower paced game and it's not as fun to watch. Do you think that if ESPN would put attention towards women's sports, maybe in the same way that they put towards building how much we care about the NFL draft, that our thoughts might be differently about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's kind of a chicken or the egg kind of thing, but you certainly don't know until you start getting coverage of these sports. And if you don't get the coverage, how are you going to build the interest in these kinds of activities? I mean, the NFL, ESPN shows that constantly, and it wasn't always the most popular sport in the United States. This happened in the 60s, so pretty relatively recently. And it happened in large part because the NFL was really tailoring itself to and kind of catering to media and to television. And so that popularity was cultivated in part through its visibility, right? And so to suggest that people aren't going to like a certain sport that's not being shown is a little bit naive. And I think that ESPN has kind of, you know, defended itself in those sort of dubious terms a lot with regards to its coverage of women's athletics.
Is a majority of ESPN's viewing audience male?
Yeah, but not as large a majority as you might think. It does attract a pretty significant amount of women viewers, and that varies depending on the sport.
ESPN has also made a significant push to try and market itself to women in mm-hmm. different ways with the creation of ESPNW. How have those ventures gone? Have they been successful?
I think in certain ways they've been successful. I mean, they have some pretty interesting content on ESPNW, and they do some pretty fascinating work. One of the things that's sort of interesting to me about ESPNW is that they've created this outlet devoted entirely to women's athletics, and it's a really nice website. They have some really great writers working for it, and they do some really interesting things. But to a certain extent, creating this outlet for women's sports is almost counterproductive in that it provides ESPN with an excuse not to show women's sports or not to cover women's sports on its main flagship channel or on its main website, etc. If you look at ESPN's flagship website, ESPN.com, ESPNW is kind of buried within it. So you wonder how productive an entity like ESPNW is when it's not very visible, when you really have to kind of search for it. And maybe those articles and those videos and whatnot would be better served or differently served if they got a little bit more attention on those platforms that ESPN has that are a little bit more visible.
So with ESPN was... It's the entertainment sports programming.
Actually, ESPN just stands for ESPN now.
ESPN Now. Originally.
Yeah,
originally,
Entertainment
though,
Sports Programming Network.
So originally, it was interested in entertainment. Whose job is it really then to report on sports? I mean, there you see like ABC and NBC, there are these other places that are devoted to sports journalism. Should we really be critiquing ESPN as not having, you know, qualified journalistic chops if that was never their intent in the first place?
Well, that's a good question. But if you have an investigative unit devoted to asking those kinds of questions and looking into these powerful entities, then you're presenting yourself as a journalistic entity. And if you present yourself as such, you're making a kind of promise, you know, to your viewers, to the public, et cetera. And I'm not suggesting that ESPN is journalistically bankrupt or anything like that. I think they produce a lot of interesting work. I think they do some good stuff. But I also think that there are kind of barriers that its commercial imperatives and sort of economic agenda create. And that it's important for us as consumers, especially with something like sports, which is just so incredibly pervasive and powerful in our culture, to think critically about this journalistic framework that it's presenting to us.
So there are other broadcasters, Fox Sports One, NBC Sports Network, CBS Sports Network, that have tried to sort of capitalize on this model of the 24-hour sports network. How is ESPN responding, and what do you think some of those competitors mean for the future of the network?
I think that, you know, ESPN will, one of the things that it does every time that, one of these new competitors emerges is that it will kind of, you know, try to hire people away or give raises to the, you know, the star people that it has in order so that, you know, to prevent them from leaving. You know, I think one of the things that, ESPN has now to its advantage is that it has this kind of brand, right? No, but, you know, another Fox Sports One might emerge and might try to be ESPN or might try to compete with ESPN, but it can't be ESPN, right? It can't use that name that is now so powerfully associated with sports media. And so I think that one of the things that ESPN does is really just kind of keep that brand front and center and really just try to reinforce this notion that it is kind of the authority.
Travis Vogan, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thanks, Lindsay.
Travis Vogan is an assistant professor of journalism and mass communication and American studies at the University of Iowa. He's author of the book ESPN, The Making of a Sports Media Empire. I'm Lindsay Moon, and you've been listening to River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for joining us.